small firm entrepreneur architects. Get ready to build a better business with the Entree Architect podcast, where business meets architecture. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, the host of Entree Architect podcast. Join me every week for inspiring interviews with passionate people that share proven strategies to help you build a better business.
If you think there is a problem, one, you can't make a move until you have a plan in place. The accountability chart really helps plan, okay, for the business 6 to 12 months out, this is what we need.
We cover it all, from financial management to marketing, sales, productivity, and beyond.
There's two sides of it, right? So there's the one when you don't have any work. So you're like, well, I'm either going to charge enough to be profitable or I'm going to go out of business. Or you have so much work and you have backlog and you don't need any more work. So you charge way more.
I'd also say lagging measures, one of the best, like the best. So for any client, for any professional service company, if you're going to take one thing away from what we're talking about today, is to look at a number called the labor efficiency ratio.
Entree Architect is not just a podcast. It's your secret weapon for success. With over 500 episodes, it's one of the longest running architecture podcasts in the world. You're sure to find the information you need to elevate your business. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe now and join the community of small firm entrepreneur architects building better businesses.
No, she did not leave Michigan.
She stayed in Michigan.
She did not leave Michigan? I thought she did.
Detroit is in Michigan.
Yeah, she stayed longer.
Hey there. Welcome to season 11 of She Builds Podcast, where we share stories about women in the design and construction field, one lady at a time.
This season, we were inspired by the number 11, which is, as you know by now, a pair of ones. So this season's theme is pairs, duos. We are talking about ladies who were a part of a professional pair in some fashion.
As always, we are not experts. We're just sharing stories about the information that we find, you know, as friends having a fun conversation. So if you find an error, send us an email and we will all continue learning.
All right. On today's episode, we will talk about Ruth Adler Schnee, a textile designer. I'm Lizzie Rahr, frolicking through Croatia, but normally coming to you from San Francisco. I'm joined by my fellow co-hosts, Nurjiti and Jessica.
I'm Nurjiti Rivas. I'm probably still in Houston, Texas.
And I'm Jessica Rogers, celebrating Alex Trebek's debut on Jeopardy back in 1984 on this day, based out of Miami, Florida.
All right. So today, ladies, our story starts in Germany.
This is super random, but Adler is one of my top 10 favorite last names.
What?
I really like it. I think it's a nice, pretty last name.
As in your favorite?
I would have been Nurjiti Adler. I would have considered it.
If you got to choose your last name?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I only think of... the Meryl Streep movie, it's complicated because her last name is Adler, or at least her husband's last name. But anyway.
Okay. Ruth Adler was born on May 13, 1923 in Frankfurt, Germany. Ruth's parents were Joseph and Marie Adler. Joseph's family had lived in Frankfurt since the 14th century, and he originally worked in the family bookstore there.
Nice.
Wow. Talk about some deep roots. And the idea of a family bookstore sounds lovely.
Mm-hmm. Marie was an artist who studied calligraphy at the Bauhaus and painting at the Hans Hofmann School in Munich. Her parents met while Joseph was on a trip to Munich, and Marie was studying there. Ruth had a brother, Charles. They lived in Frankfurt for the first 4 years of Ruth's life, but then her father decided to move into real estate, and the family moved to Dusseldorf. From what Ruth said, Frankfurt was an older, traditional city, and Dusseldorf was bigger and more modern.
Dad's an entrepreneur, mom's an artist. I see where this is going.
Yeah. Also, shout out to Bauhaus and Hans Hofmann, people and places that we've mentioned in a couple of episodes.
So, it was here that the family became friends with artists like Paul Klee and Paul Signac. Both her parents were very interested in design and art, it seems like. Ruth says that visiting Paul Klee's studio was definitely influential in her artistic interests. She always gravitated towards the more modern designs.
I feel you, Ruth.
Okay, name dropping Paul Klee, famous surrealist cubist painter, similar to Dali and Picasso, but still so inspiring.
Well, in 1933, Hitler came to power, and the Adlers were Jewish, so that changed a lot for them. Ruth now had to sit in the back of all her classes, and things started to get worse. But things really changed in 1936 with the Nuremberg Laws. After that, Ruth was no longer allowed to go to school.
Even though we know it's coming, it's still always so shocking and hurtful to hear this happened.
Agreed.
On November 9, 1938, Kristallnacht happened, and their apartment was ransacked. They had gotten word from a neighbor that the Gestapo was coming, so they weren't at the apartment when it happened, which was probably a good thing. 2 days later, Ruth's dad was arrested and taken into custody. A few weeks later, he was sent to Dachau, the first concentration camp.
No!
Oh my. Nurjiti just said it. We know it's going to happen, and it's still shocking to see when it does. But then to add how these events affect the individual and what they experienced... Oh my goodness. We've talked about Kristallnacht before too, another horrific event. But I'm happy to know that Ruth's family had noticed, but still, it's horrifying.
Yeah. Okay, so Ruth's mother during all of this was very determined and forward-thinking. She immediately started working on getting them an exit plan from Germany. She worked to get them visas sponsored by a family in New York and got their passports approved. She also worked to repair all of the furniture and belongings that were broken during Kristallnacht because the German government wouldn't let you take broken property out of the country. So she had to repair it and then get it appraised by the government and pay them that amount in order to take it with you. Essentially, you had to buy back your belongings from them.
Mm. What the what? What a racket.
Yeah.
That sounds like horrible, but kind of... good. Like, at least they get to fix their damaged furniture and their heirlooms, but still bad.
Yeah, but then you have to buy it back.
I know. It's not good. It's stupid.
Well, meanwhile, she also went every day to the Nazi agency to find out what happened with her husband and lobbied heavily to have him released. She submitted their visas to the government to ask for his release. One day, her dad showed up at home. As you can imagine, he was pretty emaciated and weak. He had been let out of the camp on the condition that he leave Germany. It was winter, and they just shoved him out the gate with no shoes in the striped pajamas. And he walked all the way to Munich and was able to find a soup kitchen that helped him and got him money to take a train back to Dusseldorf.
Okay, my heart just broke. I'm relieved that he's back with his family, but what he lived was unimaginably wrong to think that was only the beginning.
Right. It was only just the beginning. And he got out. I have never heard of this before, of someone being able to, like, advocate for someone to be released from a concentration camp. But shout out to the mother. Her perseverance and determination to get her family whole and out of there.
Yeah, I think it was early enough in them starting the camps and things like that that was lucky, you know? It was kind of a, like, yeah, if you leave the country,
right,
we'll let you go. A few days later, the family left Germany for New York. Ruth said that coming into the harbor and seeing the Statue of Liberty was very moving. And of course, the city was very foreign. They hadn't seen skyscrapers like that before. The Vail family, who sponsored them, met them at the ship and hosted them for a few days. Then they got a train bound for Detroit, where there was a job for her dad.
That was fast. I'm so glad that mom was able to set all that in motion so quickly. I bet she did not feel it was fast at all, but I'm glad that they're safe now.
Yeah. It's also great that the dad had a job lined up for them already in the States.
Yeah. Well, they arrived in Detroit and originally went there because they thought there was this job for her dad. But when they got there, it turned out there wasn't. Mm. The whole family went to work and got jobs once they were there since this other job didn't pan out. Her dad worked in a plant nursery, her mom at a mattress factory, Ruth at a bakery, and Charles sold newspapers. But before they went looking for jobs, the first thing they did when they got there was to go see the museums and the architecture of the city so they could better understand the culture. They went to the DIA, the Detroit Institute of Art, and her mother was appalled that there wasn't one modern painting in the museum at that time.
I'm not sure why I think that's funny, but I do.
Yeah. Considering that they are buddy buddies with Paul Klee, this also makes me laugh.
Yeah.
Also, what a family. Bummer about the job, but exploring a new city through a museum sounds like my kind of family.
Ruth enrolled at school and mostly focused on learning English to start. In 1940, she applied to Cass Technical High School. So going back, the story that after her dad's job didn't pan out, they seriously considered moving to Cincinnati because that's actually where they had friends. But the family stayed in Detroit partly because they wanted their kids to go to Cass. Mm. It still is an amazing art school. And Ruth applied and didn't get in at first. And actually, the exam results came back and said she wasn't accepted because she had an IQ of 42. Obviously, they were very disappointed, and her dad went down there to be like, listen, I think she just didn't do well because she doesn't have a full grasp on English yet. Could you please let her in for at least 1 year? And they said yes, and she was able to go to Cass.
Woo! I'm so happy the parents were able to advocate for her, and it all worked out.
Agreed. The language barrier was my first thought. So it's good that her parents stood up for her.
She started attending in September of 1939, and she was killing it at Cass. She really flourished there since she was so interested in art. Jessica, it kind of sounds like the high school you went to, very focused on art and design.
Yes, it does. And I was going to mention it earlier. I didn't realize that this school was around so long ago. This school still has the same reputation, but I always associated it with music, as like a music school, because alumni include Diana Ross, rapper Big Sean, and actress Lily Tomlin. My school was just like art and design, but still, this is a great school with a great reputation to this day.
Yeah. She graduated from Cass in 1942 and applied to lots of art and design colleges. She was hoping to get into Pratt or somewhere in New York, but ended up getting a full-ride scholarship to RISD, Rhode Island School of Design, in Providence. She was thrilled.
That's awesome! One of my best friends went to RISD, and my favorite architecture professor went there too, actually. So this is enough evidence for me. Great people, great school.
This was a great school.
So in 1942, she headed to Providence for 4 years. Originally, she was studying fashion, but started to feel that fashion design was too limiting and that architecture kind of encompassed all the arts. So she switched her studies to interior architecture.
Okay, Ruth. I too went to design school thinking I would do fashion, but then switched to architecture. Twinsies! There was more to the reason why I switched into architecture, but I felt like I could do more by studying architecture instead of fashion. So I resonate with her.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
She graduated in 1945 with a bachelor's in fine art. During her last year of school, she decided to enter a competition put on by Condé Nast. She talked about knowing that it was going to be difficult to get a job being both Jewish and a woman. So she thought competitions would be a smart way to go. She won the competition and they helped her get a job at Lord & Taylor's, the department store.
I like that she started out in fashion, moved to architecture, but then headed towards merging both. So that's interesting that it never left her. That's cool to see where people take their architecture degrees.
Yeah. I also like this like competition strategy to help her get a job. And yay, Lord & Taylor's, that's huge.
All right. However, she worked there 2 days and realized she didn't like it at all.
Oh,
so
okay.
She went back to Condé Nast and was like, listen, is there anything else you can connect me with? So they got her an interview with Raymond Louis.
I'm getting some Devil Wears Prada vibes up in here. Anywho's, this lady goes from one high-profile employer to the next. Raymond Louis was a French-American industrial designer who became famous for how prolific he was of a designer across a bunch of industries. A few projects to mention and clients include Shell, Exxon, TWA, and BP logos, the Greyhound bus interiors, and the Coca-Cola vending machines, and bottle redesign. Like, he's all over the place.
Icon.
He even worked for NASA, consulting on space station design. A few years after Ruth started working for him, he won the Time Magazine Person of the Year.
Wow. That's pretty cool. And I love that Ruth had the courage of leaving after 2 days when she, like, just didn't see fit. So that's cool.
Yeah. So Nergity told us how famous Raymond is, but Ruth did not know this at first. She just knew that they had an architecture department and needed a designer. So she was like, great. While she was working there, her desk was next to Minoru Yamasaki. And on her other side was Warren Plattner. And they both became close friends of hers.
Okay, I'm pretty sure we've mentioned Minoru before. He's the architect of the Twin Towers in New York. He had a style of architecture known as New Formalism. Tall, straight lines, that type of deal.
This is so cool because you have Minoru on one side. And then on the other side, you have Plattner. Warren Plattner would work with Eero Saarinen, which we had been talking about him a lot past couple weeks. Warren was an architect interior designer. He also designed furniture for like the Dulles Airport in Virginia and a couple of dormitories at Yale, just to name a few.
Yeah. So needless to say, she was rubbing shoulders with some big names or people who would become big names, right?
Yeah.
At the end of the summer, she received word that she'd been accepted at Cranbrook Academy in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan.
Okay.
We've never heard of that before, right? She had submitted her portfolio before graduating from RISD. She didn't want to leave New York, though, and go back to Michigan, but she decided getting her master's was a good idea. So in the fall of 1945, she went to Cranbrook.
This feels like the Cranbrook season.
It really does.
Mm, the Cranbrook season part two, right?
Yeah.
We've had one before?
Well.
Yeah.
Which one?
Eames. Aline.
Noel.
Eames. Florence.
Bingo. Mm.
I wonder if this time we're going to have more than three associated.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Stay tuned.
She spent the next year at Cranbrook and became friends with Eliel and Loya Saarinen.
Ooh, that's interesting. Were they close in age?
No. The Saarinens are older than her, but I think she just got close with them while she was studying there.
Mm-hmm. I see.
She also said it helped change the way she thought as a designer.
Of course it did.
While she was there, she entered another competition put on by the Chicago Tribune. She submitted a contemporary house design of steel and glass. Very Nice. And she said that the windows were so large that she didn't know of any drapery fabrics that would cover them. So she decided to design her own abstract patterns to put on draperies.
Ooh. Is this how she transitioned into textile design?
This seems very low, yeah.
So, kind of. So she won the competition, and the Tribune hosted a big reception for it in the architectural community in Chicago. The firm Shaw, Ness, and Murphy were designing car showrooms that had these huge windows, and they needed drapes for them because the car paint needed to be protected. So they saw her winning design and came up to her and said, "Your draperies are exactly what we need." And she told them, "Listen, these are just my braid. They're not real, yo."
They're about to be.
Hello.
Yeah, well, they were very insistent and gave her money and said, buy fabric, buy screens. We'll set you up with a silk screen printing business so that you can get us those drapes.
Mm.
And so that's how Ruth became a textile designer.
I am so into this.
You know, sometimes your brain thoughts can become reality. All you need is support, money, and someone to tell you that you can.
So I should also say that she graduated with her master's in fine art from Cranbrook in 1946 and took a short teaching job at Michigan State University in the fall of 1946, but only stayed one semester before going back to Detroit.
Yeah, you mentioned before she didn't want to stay in Michigan too long. Congrats on the master's, Ruth!
Yeah, well, joke's on Ruth because she ends up staying a long time, but she really liked the silk screening, so she looked for a space where she could continue to do that. She found one on 12th Street in Detroit. She was still learning about silk screening, though. She had never learned how to do it, so she self-taught herself and hired a carpenter to build her a 30-foot table, which she padded and stretched canvas over. She also had the carpenter build the screens for her.
That's neat, but I'm surprised that she didn't learn about silk screening at Cranbrook,
yeah.
Especially being friends with Loya, the famous textile designer. But Cranbrook does seem like the type of place where she could have stayed a little longer and explored those things. Still, she figured out an alternative way, and that's cool too.
Yeah, I don't think silk screening was in Loya's forte, but I will say the idea of building something that can do what you want it to do is very Loya. Because remember, she designed her own loom. So it's only fitting that Ruth would design her own silk screen printing thing. I've done silk screening before, once upon a time. It's cool. I cannot imagine a 30-foot one, though. Like, I think mine was like 18 by 24. Like, it was small.
Yeah, but like to do those big curtains, like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds so cool, though.
She had to.
Yeah.
All right. So, side story. Ruth had a friend named Richard Savage who had polio, so he was in a wheelchair. He had been away for a while, and he called Ruth up to invite her to a party the next weekend. Ruth was popular, and she apparently had dates lined up for like 3 weeks in advance. Like, okay, Ruth. But, so this was too short of notice for her schedule.
Booked and busy. Okay, social calendar full. Bleep. Please leave a message.
So she tells Richard, she says, I'm sorry, I can't come to your party, but why don't you come to Sunday dinner at our house so that I can see you and catch up? He said he could do that, but only if he was allowed to bring his schlepper.
Okay.
Basically his friend who was helping him around by pushing him in the wheelchair. She didn't love this idea because, of course, she had plans later that evening. And so it was going to be tough to get rid of two guys instead of just one. But she said, okay, but you have to leave by 5 p.m. To clarify, because that might sound really early for, like, leaving after dinner, Ruth's parents ate dinner in the afternoon on Sunday, which apparently is the European style. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But that's why she had plans in the evening. Richard came to dinner that Sunday and brought his schlepper, Edward Schnee.
This story's a little weird.
Yeah. Well, I will say one thing, that in England, like, the Sunday supper is, like, a thing. Like, yeah. Emily Blunt, the actress, talks about this. Like, it's like a whole day thing where they eat early and hang out. The schlepper comment or term seems weird to me. Sounds like more of a nurse thing. But anyway, point is that peep the last name because I feel a meet cue about to happen. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Okay, so at this first meeting, Edward and Richard convinced her to bring out some of her fabrics. And Edward loved the one that she showed them and said, I have to have that for my room. So he bought it from her at retail price, but then offered to screen print it himself.
What does this Eddie guy do for a living? Does he screen print for business or for pleasure?
I don't know. Buying it at real retail price, that's a lot of money for a schlepper. I mean, I don't know what they make, but can't be much.
Yeah, to be clear, I think he and Richard are just friends, and he's like, you know, helping him out.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a joke that he called him the schlepper. You know what I mean? Like, anyway.
I thought he was a nurse.
No. Eddie was living in New York, and he had recently graduated from Yale with a degree in economics. So he went back to New York, and they exchanged a few letters. But she didn't see him again until Christmas time when he came back to Detroit to visit. They dropped Richard off at a party he was going to and drove around Detroit talking all night. At the end of the night, he put his ring on her finger and said, I want you to have this because we're going to get married.
Whoa. That's cute, but also a little forceful. Way to let a girl feel like she has any say in this decision.
Yeah, jeez.
She was totally surprised. She didn't know him that well, but she thought he was great. And, well, it caused a bit of a stir because then her mom found out through the grapevine that they were, like, engaged and that her dad hadn't been asked first. And so it became a little bit of a thing. Mm. I won't get into the whole story because I read, this was another one where I got, like, the transcript of an interview of her life story. So there were a lot of details, but anyway, in the end, she and Eddie got married on May 23rd, 1948, and he came to live in Detroit with her.
Oh, I'm glad it worked out despite all the drama.
Maybe you can tell us a few more details in the wrap up.
Ooh.
I'll try to piece it together because it was a little bit piecemeal in how I was like, I can't quite tell what the order of events were, but
I want the tea.
He did have to go have like lunch or something with her dad. So, you know.
Ooh.
Anyway, So Ruth had been getting by with her screen printing shop, right? She had hired a few salespeople to take the fabrics to architectural offices to sell them. The front of the shop was open to the public, and so she bought an Eames chair and a Knoll table and put them in the front window. When she married Eddie, he became her business partner. He handled the retail and screen printing of the fabrics, and she handled all the design of the fabrics and any interior or architectural designs that they might have come in.
All right, I like Eddie now.
Cute! I think it's cute.
Eddie also loved to name the designs that Ruth came up with. There were things like fission chips, slits and slats, strings and things, strata, seedy weeds, and so on. It sounds like he had a lot of fun with it.
He's growing on me. I'd like to name finishes. That sounds like such a fun job for me. I get it, Eddie.
Yeah, I'm not too sure about those names, but like to each their own, I guess.
I like strings and things.
They're playful.
Seedy weeds, fish and chips. Oh, that's weird. Yeah. But I do love a good collab, so that's nice.
They were a true team. Mm-hmm. In 1949 or 1950, the Art Institute sponsored an exhibit about contemporary interiors and furnishings. They featured designers like Jens Riesum, Alexander Girard, and Florence Knoll, and had them present. Okay, so this is background info, because what happened was that people in the city who saw this exhibit went to the big department store in Detroit, Hudson's. And the Hudson sales reps didn't know squat about contemporary furniture. But Ruth did. So they found that many people were coming into their shop to ask about furnishings and modern fabrics after this exhibit. In the end, this sparked the idea that they should start selling these modern furnishings. So they opened up a larger space on Puritan in Detroit. That's how they became the go-to contemporary furniture and textile shop in Detroit.
Hot dang.
Loving it.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know the exact years, but Ruth and Eddie had three children, the last of which was born in 1954. Ruth said she doesn't think she ever found the solution in how to have children and a career. She talked about times where her clothes were drenched in milk because she had to be somewhere for work and her child wasn't there to feed. As the kids got older, she brought them with her to job sites and other craftspeople she worked with. It sounds like Eddie was a huge help as well, taking over a lot of the time when she had to go out to meetings or even take business trips.
Sounds to me like part of the solution is a good partner that accepts that children are 100% his responsibility too and acts like it.
That part. And I have to commend Ruth for talking about this so candidly.
Yeah. Now, by this time, Minoru Yamasaki was also working in Detroit. And so he gets Ruth to design the interiors of some of his projects. She also made connections with several local department stores and designed the interiors for all their locations. She also worked with him on a gynecology office. And by this time, she was pregnant with her third child. So she suggested putting a fun wallpaper with pregnant birds on the ceiling so that when you're lying there on the table, you aren't looking at pipes and a boring ceiling. Yamasaki didn't like that and nixed it. Years later, one of the doctors from the clinic told her, "We built another clinic on the east side of Detroit and we used the birds. And the birds were such a success. The women called us and thanked us for putting something interesting on the ceiling."
I get Minoru's point, because bird wallpaper doesn't gel well with his new formalism aesthetic. But then I get Ruth Moore, who actually understands the user and is thinking more about them than architecture theory. So thanks, Ruth.
I'm annoyed that Minoru didn't see the vision because, hello, we look at ceilings all the time. It wouldn't hurt to add some pizzazz. But I like that the other doctor saw the vision, and I would have been team wallpaper on the ceiling.
Yeah.
They could have come up with a wallpaper that satisfied Minoru and Ruth.
Exactly.
Correct. Ruth went on to work with other well-known architects on the interiors of their projects, such as the redesign of the Ford Rotunda with Buckminster Fuller, the General Motors Technical Center with Eero Saarinen, the Affleck House by Frank Lloyd Wright, and eventually the lobby of the World Trade Center with Minoru Yamasaki.
Wow, this lady worked on big-name projects with big-name architects. She's a big lady in her own right. We should be learning about her in school.
Yeah.
I hope interior design students know her name at least.
Yes. Interior design students, check in. What's up? Have you heard of her before?
So Adler Schnee kept growing, and they moved locations a few times until they were finally located in downtown Detroit at Harmony Park's Hemeter Building in 1964. They were right near Hudson's and other major retail shops. However, in 1967, there were riots in downtown Detroit, and people didn't want to come shopping downtown anymore. Ruth and Eddie worked hard to come up with marketing campaigns for their store over the years and were recognized by the city council as having single-handedly stabilized a corner of downtown Detroit. But sadly, downtown never bounced back for shopping in that way, and so they closed their store in 1976.
Oh, man.
That's interesting. I remember hearing about the Detroit riots, but always in respect of like Motown and music, never in the aspect of like retail and design.
Yeah. Ruth continued to receive commissions for interior design work over the years until in the 90s, her textile designs made a resurgence. A few companies started reproducing her designs and selling them worldwide. Adler Schnee partnered with Anzia Textiles in 1994. Through the 90s and into the 2000s, Ruth's work has gotten much more recognition. And in 2015, she signed a 20-year contract with Knoll Textiles to create new designs for the company.
This is so great. Also, so at 92 years old, Ruth signed a contract to create work for the next 20 years. I feel like these people know something that we don't.
I mean, that just sounds like good business and design right there. I love it. And if you recall the time we played bingo, I was wondering when Knoll Furniture would come up because Ruth was in our bingo cards. So
yeah, for sure. A lot of the articles I read about that contract were kind of laughing at the fact that they were giving her a 20-year contract at 92 years old. But, you know, I mean, get it.
Well, she has a company, right?
Like, yes, yes.
People can continue her work. But it's still kind of funny.
I know, I know. Ruth was quoted saying, "It's been a wonderful career. I'm glad the work I designed 70 years ago is now being recognized and that Ed and I were able to spread the gospel of modern design. I am not a believer that women can't break the glass ceiling. I really strongly believe if women do a good job and they are talented and they are dependable, they will get ahead. Chauvinism has never stopped me. The wheel of modernism has come full circle and I couldn't be happier."
Whew. Well, it's not that women can't break the glass ceiling. It's that we even have to break it to begin with. And It's that it's really damn hard. Okay, chauvinism didn't stop her. That's amazing and inspiring to keep going no matter what. I'm glad she lived that life. But that doesn't mean that other women don't face even harder challenges. Just saying, Ruth.
Yeah, I hate quotes like these because, like you said, Nerjity, just because she didn't experience it, that doesn't mean that it didn't happen to others or that it even continues to happen today. She is privileged to have people on her corner that supported her and that helped her. She is talented, yes, but she's also really lucky.
Yeah, that's true. And to clarify, I didn't include a lot of the things she talked about where she experienced a lot of the chauvinism and that kind of thing. And I think she had to learn to let it roll off her back and just keep going and not care about it. And not to say that that's easy for anyone, but obviously, like, she was lucky to have made the connections she did in order to get where she got.
But even I think acknowledging that, like, the chauvinism and then just how you face it is one thing versus just saying, like, I don't get it. Why can't you move past it? Like, I don't know.
Right. I guess I'm clarifying that I don't think she meant chauvinism. Like, I never experienced it and I don't know what people are talking about. I think she's saying that even though there was so much chauvinism in the industry, it didn't stop me from continuing to move forward.
Yeah, she should have said it like that then.
Ruth received the 2015 Kresge Eminent Artist Award and the Women in the Arts Lifetime Achievement Award and the American Institute of Architects International Color Award. In 2010, she received an honorary doctorate from the Center for Creative Studies in Detroit. In 2011, she had a solo exhibition at the Venice Biennale and one at the Smithsonian in 2012.
Okay, accolades.
Eddie died on September 1st, 2000, and as you heard before, Ruth kept on going and designed after he passed away. In 2019, Ruth moved to Colorado Springs from Michigan to be closer to her kids. On January 5th, 2023, she passed away at the age of 99.
Wait, what? So she died like last year?
So what happens with the next 15 years of her contract? Does she have a firm and are they still producing work?
Yeah, I mean, I assume that they'll keep producing her previous designs, but obviously they're not getting new ones from her. So that's what I know about that. I didn't read anything that says, like, that contract is void now, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's still Zaha Hadid, the architecture firm, right? So I just wonder who's taking on the torch now.
Yeah, that I don't know.
All right, we've now reached the second part of our episode, the Caryatid. A caryatid is a stone carving of a woman used as a column or a pillar to support the structure of a Greek or Greek-style building. In each episode, we choose a caryatid, a woman who's working today, furthering the profession through her work, and who ties into the historical woman of our episode. Without further ado, drum roll, please.
Eva Shonaike.
Woo! Yeah!
Okay, so Eva is a German-born Nigerian designer. She now lives in London and was originally a journalist, but pivoted into interior design and textile design. She founded her own interiors company, Eva Shonaike, in 2009. The company's ethos is bringing color to life.
That's a nice slogan.
I love a second career story from journalism to interior design and textile. Ah, so cool.
She takes inspiration from growing up in Germany and the European mid-century influences, along with her home country of Nigeria, and different African textiles and colors to create her textile designs. Each collection she creates has a narrative. She said in 2023, "Kano, my most recent collection, is named after a city in northern Nigeria in Kano State, formerly a trans-Saharan trade route, which is a city of kings and queens. I envisaged a story using textiles. I always start with the colors, which take a long time because I want them to translate the story accurately. Then I design and create the overall package."
Love all that thought and narrative going into her designs.
Yeah, that sounds really beautiful. Can't wait to see pictures.
Her designs have been sold at Selfridges in London, Liberty, and she collaborated with Soho House. Her company also does interior design work as well, and you can check her out on the Netflix documentary Made by Design. I tried to look for this documentary on Netflix in the US and couldn't find it, so I don't know if it's only available in other countries, but I'm really wanting to watch it, so Netflix US, bring it to us.
Yes, please!
Ooh. Yes, because I want to see it, but if not, if you go on YouTube, she has like a series called Making Britain Home.
Okay, let's add that to our watch list.
Yep.
All right. Before we say goodbye, we want to say thank you to CMYK for the music, John W., our technical advisor, and most of all, thank you for listening.
Remember to check out our show notes for links to all of our resources on this episode, as well as pictures of projects that we've talked about.
We hope you enjoyed learning about today's lady and caryatid along with our banter, and that you're inspired to find out more about them and other amazing professional ladies.
Please let us know what you thought of our episode. If you enjoyed it, please help us spread the word. Tell your friends, your colleagues, your history buffs. Tell them all. Also, give us 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify. Write us a review. This all helps us reach a wider audience and for more people to learn about amazing ladies with us.
Your support means everything to us. If you've enjoyed our content and want other ways to help us with our mission, you can support us by visiting our website for merchandise at shebuildspodcast.com/merch.
If you don't need any more swag, but you'd still like to consider supporting the research we're doing, you can donate to us on our website, shebuildspodcast.com/donate. Or you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/shebuildspodcast. You can also find links to all of these items on our website.
She Builds Podcast is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com.
We are excited to hear from you and for you to come back and keep learning about bosses with us. You can email us your thoughts at shebuildspodcast@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our website, shebuildspodcast.com, or follow us on Instagram and Facebook at shebuildspodcast and on X at shebuildspod. Bye.
Bye.
Adios.
Thank you.
Also, Niesa, you've never been more Midwestern in your life.
There you go.
Niesa.
Are you NCARB certified yet? Join the network of over 45,000 architects who have the NCARB certificate to expand your professional reach.
By becoming NCARB certified, like I did, you are demonstrating that you've met the national standards for licensure, a qualification that can be an important factor for firms when hiring and promoting. Certificate holders have a streamlined path to apply for a reciprocal license in all 55 U.S. jurisdictions, as well as access to an extensive library of free continuing education courses.
Learn more at ncarb.org.